it is February 16th, 2022 in Hawaii over the internet, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, The Creation of the Fourth Order, Chapter 29, Talks Between Narada and King Prachinibarhi, Text 85.
Mataji, can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
So, Ash.
Adhyatma Parokshamidam. Maya Jigatam Adbhutam. Evam Shri Ashrama Pumsas. Chino Mutra Cha Samshaya.
Chino Mutra Cha Samshaya.
Please chant.
Adhyatma paroksham idam.
Adhyatma paroksham idam.
Maya digatam adbhutam.
Maya digatam adbhutam.
Evam striya shrama pum sash.
Evam striya shrama pum sash.
Chino mutra. Chinna mutra cha samshayaha.
Chinna mutra cha samshayaha. Adhyatma paroksham idam.
Spiritual.
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 Paroksham.
Paroksham.
Described by authority.
Described by authority.
Idam.
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 This.
This.
Yes.
Maya.
Maya.
By me.
By me.
By me.
Adigatam.
Adigatam.
Heard.
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 Adbhutam.
Adbhutam.
Wonderful.
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 Avam.
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 Thus.
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 Striya.
Striya.
With a wife.
With a wife.
With a wife.
Ashramaha.
Ashrama.
Shelter.
Shelter.
Kumshaha.
Kumshaha.
Of the living entity.
Of the living
entity.
China.
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 Finished.
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 Amutra.
Amutra.
About life after death.
About life after death.
Cha.
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 Also.
Also.
Samshayaha.
Samshayaha.
Doubt.
Doubt.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. The allegory of King Puranjana, described herein according to authority, was heard by me from my spiritual master, and it is full of spiritual knowledge. If one can understand the purpose of this allegory, he will certainly be relieved from the bodily conception and will clearly understand life after death. Although one may not understand what transmigration of the soul actually is, one can fully understand it by studying this narration. All right, I'm hoping that all of you noticed something interesting about the relationship between the Sanskrit, the word for word, and the translation, which is also going to be brought out in the purport. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The word striya, meaning along with the wife, is significant. The male and female living together constitute the sum and substance of material existence. The attraction between male and female in this material world is very strong. In all species of life, the attraction between male and female is the basic principle of existence. The same principle of intermingling is also in human society, but it is in a regulated form. Material existence means living together as male and female and being attracted by one another. However, when one fully understands spiritual life, his attraction for the opposite sex is completely vanquished. By such attraction, one becomes overly attached to this material world. It is a hard knot within the heart. Pumsa striya maituna bhava etam tayor mito hridaya grantim ahu ato griha kshetra sutapta vitayar janasya mahoyam aham mameti. Bhagavatam 5.5.8. That's, of course, Rishabdev instructing his sons. Everyone comes to this material world attracted to sense gratification, and the hard knot of sense gratification is the attraction between male and female. By this attraction, one becomes overly attached to the material world in terms of griha, kshetra, sutta, apta, vita, that is, home, land, children, friends, money, and so forth. Thus, one becomes entangled in the bodily conception of I and mind. However, if one understands the story of King Paranjana and understands how, by sexual attraction, Paranjana became a female in his next life, one will also understand the process of transmigration. Adhyatma paroksham idam maya digatam adbutam evam striyashrama pumsa chinamutra tatsam saiha. The allegory of King Paranjana, described herein according to authority, was heard by me from my spiritual master, and it is full of spiritual knowledge. If one can understand the purpose of this allegory, he will certainly be relieved from the bodily conception and will clearly understand life after death. Although one may not understand what transmigration of the soul actually is, one can fully understand it by studying this narration. So the first thing that jumped out at me was how in the Sanskrit we have Striyashramaha, the shelter of the wife. And Prabhupada starts out the purport with saying that this Striyashrama is very significant, but it's not in the translation. It's just not there. It's not even there indirectly. And such a situation is not uncommon. I've not done a statistical analysis, but my guess from spending all of my adult life reading Srila Prabhupada's books daily, that it's very common. That there's some lack of consistency between the Sanskrit, the word for word, the translation, and the purport. And I gotta say, it's extremely common. And this of course, touches on a very controversial area. To some extent, I try to avoid controversy in my class, and to some extent, I don't. And that is the posthumous editing of Srila Prabhupada's books. So one of the criteria that the BBT editors have used for editing Srila Prabhupada's books after his disappearance from this world is consistency. Is trying to create consistency between one part of the books and another, between Srila Prabhupada's purports and translations and the words and the tikkas of the acharyas, and by having consistency between the translation word-for-word, the word-for-word translation and the purport. However, this consistency is very clearly something that Srila Prabhupada was not concerned about at all. I mean, it's so pervasive that it was something that just didn't interest him. And one example of this is in Bhagavad Gita 12.12, where Srila Prabhupada's translation does not match. It's a verse where Krishna is saying, if you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. If you can't do this, do this. And so it would seem logically that the order of things in that verse is of primary importance, because Krishna is giving an order. He's giving a sequence. So to get the sequence right seems to be rather imperative, but it's not. And nor is the sequence explained in the purport the way it's explained in the verse. And in fact, a number of our Vaishnavacharyas, in their own commentaries on that verse, spent quite a bit of effort and detail going into why that Krishna is giving that particular sequence. So Jayadvaita, at that time, Ramachari, asked Srila Prabhupada about it and asked Prabhupada if it should be fixed. And Prabhupada said, no. He said, it's not important. What's important is that bhakti is supreme and that everything else is lower. And the order of the lower things, what's lower than what's higher than what, is not important. And so he said, don't fix it. Now, I also find that example interesting, because one of the reasons given for the posthumous editing is that Srila Prabhupada didn't have the time to go through and check over his books before they were published. He basically, according to the editors, he basically just turned them over to editors, said, you know, do what you like, and he would check a few things here and there, but he would basically just wave his hand and say, you know, that's all right, except for some things that he checked. Now, we know with the artwork, he was very exacting, and he checked every bit of all of the artwork, but not necessarily all of the writing. And so they say, well, Prabhupada just didn't have the time, he was in a rush, and therefore now we have to go back and make everything the way he would have wanted it. But what I see is that that wasn't what Srila Prabhupada wanted. It just wasn't. You know, that might be what I would want for my books or what you might want for your books. But it wasn't something that Prabhupada wanted for his books. And why he didn't want it for his books, I honestly don't know. That's a question for him. What do you want for your own books? How do you want your own books to be? So I just thought I would point that out, that this is, it jumped at me immediately, as I'm sure it did for many of you. And you're just like, well, wait a minute. why, Srila Prabhupada, are you telling me something is very significant in the verse that you don't put in the translation, that you just talk about in the purport? But anyway, as I said, that's quite common. There'll be things in the translation that aren't touched on in the purport, and things in the purport, this situation, where Prabhupada will highlight something from the verse in the purport that is completely absent from the translation. All right, let's look at the points that Srila Prabhupada's making here in his purport. So he's talking about, and this is a recurring theme throughout the Shastra and throughout Srila Prabhupada's teaching, of the problem with the attraction between male and female, the problem with sexual attraction, the problem with family life, the problem with as the center of material life, as the center of mundane attraction, as the center of bodily identification. So if we look at the religions of the world, the primary religions of the world, we find that most of them do have, say, monastic order. So among the Eastern Orthodox Christians and among the Roman Catholic Christians, I'm pretty sure Roman Catholic Christians are still the majority of the Christians in the world, there is a monastic order for both men and women. So there's a facility, and all of the priests, of course, are celibate, and then there's monks and there's nuns, and it's those people are held in very high esteem in their church, and it's considered to be a glorious life. Of course, Buddhism is the same, and there are even countries, I believe in Thailand and Burma perhaps, where all of the young boys are required to spend some time as a Buddhist monk before they grow up, maybe 2 months or something, but there's some time living as a Buddhist monk. And of course, in the different Vedic paths, whether you're a follower of Lord Shiva or a follower of Durga or a follower of Krishna or any of the demigods, or whether you're impersonalist or personalist, a monastic order is very much part of the culture. So the concept that young people should, again, something like the concept among the Buddhists, that young people should have some time when they live in a renounced way. And some people will be lifetime renunciates. And of course, in the Varnashram system, the idea is that everyone becomes some kind of a renunciate at the end of life, whether with or without the spouse. I know Judaism does not have a monastic order at all. And then, of course, Protestant Christians also don't have a monastic order. I don't know. I'm not aware of any Protestant denomination that has a monastic order. But the concept that living without the opposite sex, that living without either a subtle or gross sexual relationship, is something that is helpful in spiritual life and something to be revered and something to be aspired for. Now, generally in monastic orders, there's a lot of tapasya in addition to that. So there's usually austerities in terms of dress. Usually in monastic orders, there's some sort of a uniform, and you basically wear the same clothes every day. You don't have different outfits. You can't say, oh, I wear this on that day and this on the other day. And the clothing is generally very, very simple. There's often a lot of simplicity of food. So a lot of the demarcations given in the Bhagavatam between like the four different levels of sannyas all have to do with food, how you get your food. So this is also part of the monastic orders. You have some Christian monks who eat just like, bread and soup, for example. Things like that, very, very simple. Often there's simplistic arrangements for sleeping. that one will sleep on the floor instead of on a bed. There may also be simplistic things such as not having shoes. There are usually some sort of regulations about possessions. So I know that there are Buddhist monks where all of their possessions have to fit into some standard issue bag, you know, almost like the military or something, where you have a bag and everything you have has to fit in that one bag. A lot of modern travel kind of forces us like that. You know, you have a certain size, a weight bag you can bring on the plane, and you've got to fit everything in there. So that kind of thing. So it's not mostly with these monastic orders, it's not just about sex, although that's the primary. So we will see that there are renunciates who maybe don't follow all kinds of austerities and other things, but they at least follow it in sex. Oh, usually in the monastic orders, there's also things that have to do with money. So it's usually in the monastic orders, you don't have an occupation. You don't have a livelihood, you don't have any means of earning money, and you live on charity. There are many monastic orders that actually take vows of poverty. So no matter how much they receive in charity, they immediately give it away and they keep themselves in poverty. At the same time, in every major religion in the world, there are also families. First of all, there's actually, I'm not sure if the Muslims have a monastic order or not. I'm not very schooled in Islam. I was thinking, oh, that's a pretty major religion. But I'm not sure about that at all. It's something I know very little about. But all the major religions also emphasize family life as something glorious. So it's interesting that even while having monastic renounced orders and glorifying them and revering them and often requiring that certain levels of spiritual leadership are also renunciates, there's a lot of push for a pious family life. And that's also very common. And sociologically speaking, no religion has ever survived without large numbers of children that are socialized into the religion. It just hasn't happened. There's no religion that has survived and thrived only on converts. We can say, you know, Islam is the fastest growing religion, but far more than converts are the fact that they have a lot of children. And they really push their families to produce a lot of children. Of course, in many parts of the world, they practice polygamy, which also tends to greatly increase the population. So that it's quite common. And Islam is growing primarily through children. And then the concept, why have family life? Well, because the vast majority of people cannot live life as a renunciate. They just can't. They can't do it honestly. And we have, in societies like our Hare Krishna movement, where we have purports like this all throughout Prabhupada's books, one of the negative results is people artificially taking up a life of renunciation for prestige, which is one of the things that Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in his commentary on Manashiksha verse 6, as a way of bathing in donkey urine where you think you're actually getting pure. So he says to take up the dress of a renunciate for prestige. And I would add not just the dress, but the life of a renunciate. And so, you know, at least once or twice a month, I find out about somebody, usually a man, but also sometimes women, who have not married and taken up renounced life, and then they get to be older. You know, they get to be in their 30s or 40s or 50s, and they say, oh my God, I have to get married. And often, for a long time, they were living deceptive lives, watching porn and so forth and so on. I mean, it's quite common. It's really quite common. It's something, again, at least once or twice a month, I run into this. And then when people finally, you know, at the wrong time, after artificially trying to be a renunciate and trying to force themselves into something that they weren't doing and being duplicitous in their behavior, when they finally realize that, wow, you know, I need to be with the opposite sex, I need to take care of this, they often get involved in marriage in some kind of scandalous way. They have a very hard time adjusting to married life, a very hard time adjusting to psychologically taking care of the spouse. They may have a lot of guilt and shame about their decision and so forth. And it becomes a huge problem. Of course, then getting married later, it becomes that much harder to have children. There's a lot of fertility issues, and then there's a lot of issues to have children so late in life, and your children are so young when you're 70 years old, like Ajamila, who had, you know, a little tiny child when he's 88. So there's so many difficulties with this artificial renunciation. And then a lot of this artificial renunciation gives a bad name to the renounced orders. So the renounced orders are supposed to be highly regarded in society, but when we see so many examples of people supposedly being in a renounced order but actually amassing huge amounts of wealth and enjoying a lot of subtle enjoyment from the opposite sex, and maybe secretly having fall down here and there for years and years and years, then the whole thing becomes disturbed. And the whole concept of having monastic orders in the society becomes twisted. Then you also have, just in many religions, instead of seeing marriage as a necessity to be used in service, they glorify marriage in and of itself. And we see this especially when I'm aware of with what I interact with would be most of the Protestant religious systems that, again, don't have monastic orders. And they often glorify family life as like the pinnacle of religiousness. You know, that if you're just, like Prabhupada said, it should be regulated. So if you're just regulated in your family life, you know, if you can marry somebody, if you don't have any relationship with anybody else before marriage, and then you marry one person that you stick with your whole life, and you don't get divorced, and you don't get remarried, you don't have any affairs, and you raise nice children, and you have an honest livelihood, that this is, you know, some kind of really spiritual thing. Of course, such a thing used to be practically just like the ordinary norm in society if we go back, you know, 50 or 100 years. So this is also a problem where family life becomes glorified in and of itself. Of course, the same can be true for monastic life. If one glorifies it in and of itself and doesn't see it as simply service. What is it? Grihe tako, vane tako. It doesn't matter whether you're living in family life or in the forest. The point is to chant Hare Krishna. All right, so why is it that we have, what are we attracted to? Prabhupada is making the point here that we're really attracted to the opposite sex. Of course, some people are attracted to the same sex. But why are we attracted to a sexual, romantic situation? What is it we're looking for there? And why is that, you know, over and over and over again, what Prabhupada's saying here? It's just like this pounding theme. This is your problem. This is your problem. So why do we want it? Well, one thing, reason we want it is that we want to feel complete. We want to feel whole. So the male and female energy in and of itself is off, tends to be off balance. Huh? If women are just with women, men are just with men. There can become an excess of the tendencies of each of the genders. Speaking, of course, in a very general way. And the vast majority of us need to have some energy of the opposite sex in order to feel whole, to feel balanced. And I've noticed this even with the majority that I'm aware of homosexual couples, where one of the persons tends to take on more of the characteristics of the other sex. So it's very, very common that in a male homosexual couple, one of the men is more feminine, and in female homosexual couples, one of the women is more masculine. And this tendency, right? And of course, this is true not only with a romantic partner, but in general, that in society, that men and women complement each other, and the male and female energy complement each other. And if you don't have that, you feel off balance. You don't really feel whole and balanced. As I said, when you have just men together or just women together, the excesses of that gender tend to dominate society and tend not to be a very healthy thing. Then we also want to feel loved. You know, in your romantic, with your romantic partner, generally speaking, you really have this huge amount of trust. Right? Generally, with your romantic partner, you share a domicile, and you sleep in the same home, Right, we're very, very vulnerable when we're sleeping. You know, when we sleep, we make sure our doors are locked and our windows are closed and our burglar alarms are set. But then there's people that we're sleeping with in the house. You know, we're trusting them. Generally, with your romantic partner, you're sharing a bank account, or at least you have access to each other's bank accounts. You're sharing a car. You're cooking for each other. Maybe you're sharing your passwords for your computer. I mean, you know, you're really trusting that this is somebody who has my best interest in mind, and I have their best interest in mind. And it's this kind of really feeling loved, of really feeling cared for, of really feeling supported. And there is somebody with whom I can feel authentic. You know, the concept is that of all the people in our lives, that especially with our romantic partner, that they're going to see us at our best and they're going to see us at our worst. And they're going to love us anyway. They're going to have a balanced view of us. That when they see us at our best, they're not going to engage in hero worship, and which is artificial. And when they see us at our worst, they're not going to demonize us, which is also artificial. They're going to see both, and they're going to see us in a holistic, balanced way, and they're going to love us in a holistic, balanced way. And also for a sense of security. You know, here is somebody when I need it. I'm sick, somebody takes care of me. You know, if I'm injured, I'm sick, I have some kind of problem, someone's going to help take up the slack. I'm not alone. And I have companionship in the good times, I have help in the bad times, and someone that I can love. There's nothing more pleasurable than to love somebody. I mean, there's all this evidence how being in love activates all of the pleasure systems in the brain, much more so than practically anything else that we do. So this sense of loving someone, of being able to give myself in love to somebody, and somebody that's willing to receive it. You know, generally in our life, most people are not interested in receiving our full quota of love. It's too much. It's overwhelming for them, right? If you give everything to somebody, they're like, whoa, back off, you know? But in romantic relationships, the idea is that, yes, you really do give yourself wholly. It's someplace where you can just, like, pour your love into someone else. And then, of course, you create life. You create children out of your sexual relationship. And you're creating life through your livelihood, where you're creating wealth and you're creating prosperity. You're creating life through your children, and you really feel like you're doing something for the world, like you're contributing to the world, unlike those who are renunciates, who often withdraw from the world. And in many monastic orders, they withdraw from the world and they primarily take care of themselves and their own spiritual life. So these are the things that are attractive about particularly the romantic relationship over and above our other relationships, our relationships of master and servant, our relationships of, well, neutrality, where we just admire someone, of master and servant, of friends, and a relationship we have with our children, our students, our subordinates, or the relationship we have with our parents. This romantic relationship, it has this attractiveness to it. Of course, our experience of the romantic relationship generally falls short of this desire in some way or another. And if it didn't, we wouldn't have half of first marriages ending in divorce and more than half of second marriages ending in divorce. And even marriages that don't end up in divorce are often not very happy. More than half of all murders take place between intimate sexual partners. Or a small percentage of this, of those. There's 55% of all murders have to do with intimate sexual partners or ex-sexual partners, and 5% of those are those related to the intimate sexual partners, like maybe your brother-in-law or something like that. So we have these high expectations and high desires for this relationship, but the reality of it usually falls short. You know, for people to really experience a relationship where they feel whole and balanced and supported in love, and they can fully give love, and they create life, and they have security, and they have full authenticity, is definitely not the norm that people experience. they experience some portion of that, or they experience it sometimes, but there's usually some sorrow. There's some lack. There's some emptiness still. There's something hollow. There's something unfulfilled. And it's very rare that a person will really say, you know, well, with my spouse, with my romantic partner, I'm completely fulfilled all of the time. And, of course, the reason for that is that what we're looking for is Krishna. We cannot be Krishna for the other person, and nor can the other person be Krishna for me. They're a jiva. It's just not possible. They don't have the capacity. If we think about, you know, a phone battery, so the battery in my, I've got a really good battery in my phone. I have to charge it once a day. It lasts for a long time, but it can only power my phone. My phone battery can't power my laptop. It can't power all the lights in my room. It can't power a car. So, you know, the need of the soul is actually unlimited. It's actually for the unlimited. We want to be connected with the unlimited. And therefore, just having this with a romantic partner doesn't satisfy us. But it's the closest we can come to what we're looking for with Krishna. So it's very glittering and it's very attractive. And we're thinking, wow, this is where I'm going to find Krishna. But as long as we're attracted by that glitter, we're not going to find Krishna. It's going to keep us from him. And because it's not fully satisfying, as Prabhupada says here, we're going to take birth after birth after birth, trying to find a situation that's satisfying. You know? Of course, people do it in this life, getting divorced and remarried over and over again, or going from one partner to another without marriage, and thinking, you know, well, this one will be it, well, this one will be it. And then we do it again in another life, well, this one will be it, well, this one will be it. But unless it's Krishna, it's not going to be it. It's just not. So therefore, Rupa Goswami prays, Yuvati namita yuni yuvam cha yuvatoyata manobramate tadvan manome ramatam twai. He says, just like young boys and girls have this natural attraction to each other, let me have a natural attraction to you. I really like this letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote to my god sister Sacharya, where he said, you're a married woman, and so you want to please your husband in all respects. And he said, it's natural to be attached to the husband, but you should minimize this, and instead you should become attached to Krishna. So I like the juxtaposition of you should please your husband in all respects, but not out of attachment to him. You should do it out of attachment to Krishna. So the recognition is there that the vast majority of human beings need to be in a regulated romantic partnership. That hardly any human beings can live a genuinely renounced life without cheating of some sort. It just does not seem to be the norm for a human being. In fact, Srila Prabhupada writes about how in the spiritual world there are men and women. Vaikuntha is made up of all couples, as is Ayodhya, as is Dwarka, as is Mathura, even Vrindavan. You know, there's so many, that everyone has family. It's all families. Prabhupada said there's no sannyasis in Vrindavan. Of course, Narada visits there sometimes. But Narada also has a family, Srivas Thakur, which is interesting. So this is the natural state for the vast majority of human beings, is to be in a regulated romantic partnership, not to be a renunciate. That's just the reality. I mean, some people are wired that for lifetime renunciation, but it's a tiny, tiny portion. So the concept is to use that relationship, like in Vaikuntha, to glorify the Lord, and not to become attached to trying to enjoy that relationship for one's self. It's a very simple principle. It's not a difficult principle to understand. It may be a difficult principle to apply, because we have such a long cherished, as Prabhupada would say, desire to enjoy this world, which causes us then to see the other people in our life, our spouse, our children, our friends, our pets, whatever, as enjoyable objects, who are there to meet my needs, who are there to satisfy me. And I will satisfy them simply because that way they'll be induced to satisfy me. You know, if I pay you, then you're likely to, you know, I need some work done. I need my house painted. So if I pay you, you're likely to do a good job, and if I ask you to do it for free, you're not likely to do a good job. Or if I try to find some super cheap painter, then I'm likely to get a super cheap paint job. So we may take care of other people as a kind of payment, as a kind of merchant exchange. Well, I'll give you security and love and authenticity with the hope that I'll get it back from you. We don't want that kind of relationship, but we're habituated to having that kind of relationship. It's hard to break out of. We know we have that kind of relationship if when we don't get the reciprocation that we want, we become angry and frustrated and bitter. We become offended. Or wherever, you know, anytime people don't reciprocate with us the way that we want. But rather, our mood should be, our practice should be, my needs are getting fulfilled by serving Krishna. I'm not serving Krishna to meet my needs. Of course, initially we are. But I'm serving Krishna because I love Krishna and my needs are naturally fulfilled as a side benefit. I mean, some example we have of this is people who dedicate themselves to a cause. And, you know, they dedicate themselves to some kind of mission. And then they're naturally taken care of. You know, they really care about the company they work for and they really care about the company's mission. And then naturally they get a salary and they get a place to work and they get their equipment. But they're not doing it for that. In fact, people who work just for money are not very satisfied. But people are working for some higher cause and the money is incidental. And if you're really working for a good company, you don't even have to worry about that. The company will take care of everything you need, and you just focus on working for the company. You forget about your needs. So serving Krishna is like that. You become absorbed in serving Krishna, and you forget about your needs because Krishna is just naturally taking care of them. And then because you're fulfilled with Krishna, therefore you can serve others without a concern as to what you get out of it and what kind of reciprocation they give you and so forth. And then you're not really going into family life to feel balanced and whole and supported and loved and authenticity and security and all those things because you already have all those things in Krishna. So then why would you go into married life at all? Why not just be a renunciate? Because there's service in married life and because it's the most natural position for the body and mind. And therefore we find that the majority of the Mahajanas are married, that the vast majority of the devotees in the Bhagavatam are married, at least during the youthful portion of their life. But they do so as a service to the Lord. Now, even if that's done, because the tendency is so strong to want to be exploitive in that relationship, that therefore there's a certain point even in the married life where one takes up some form of renunciation, at least even with the spouse, where one says, okay, now we're going to give up at least our gross sexual relationship, work on giving up the subtle sexual relationship, retire from earning money, and together work as partners in spiritual life, that glorification of the Lord. There was a video that some friend of mine posted the other day from one temple of these devotees singing. It was like 30 minutes of devotees singing one mantra for Lord Nisingadeva over and over and over. And over and over and over and over again while there was a fire yajna going on. And it was very staged. You know, it's funny, I've seen this with Buddhist monks. I've seen it with transcendental meditation people. I hadn't seen it with Gaudiya Vaishnavas before. So this huge temple room, and there were mats on the floor at evenly spaced intervals, and you had all these men. Some were brahmacharis, some were wearing saffron, some were wearing white. You had all these men, each of them were sitting, they all were dressed the same except for the colors, and they were all sitting like, you know, really stick straight there on the mats, and they were all chanting this Nisinga mantra as, it was definitely attractive, although I was thinking, you know, kirtans that aren't quite so staged, it can be more attractive. But the main thing that struck me is that it was all men, that there were no women's voices, and I was thinking how, you know, sometimes choirs with all male voices are attractive, or choirs with all female voices are attractive. But it's usually the mix of them that's more attractive. When you have the mixing of the male and female voices, or like in an orchestra, so you have, you know, the different kinds of instruments. You have the wind instruments, you have the string instruments, you have the percussion instruments. And even among the instruments, some of them are treble and some of them are bass. that you have the little piccolo flute, and then you have the bass clarinet, and you have the violin, and you have the bass cello, and you know, this range makes for beauty. And then, of course, each of us is beyond gender. Each of us is so individual. And to have this combination, and Prabhupada says this, that in the spiritual world there's male and female, not for sense gratification, but for the service of the Lord. So that is what we are aiming for. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Chastisements?
Everybody can unmute themselves. Sorry, I forgot.
They can unmute themselves. Okay.
I have a question.
All right.
I had an interesting discussion with a godbrother yesterday. And it's something that I guess I've discussed many times with different leaders in our society, particularly those that have accepted the responsibility of initiation. And that question is, the whole spectrum from one end to the other, or what Prabhupada meant or expected with the principle of no illicit sex.
Oh, goodness. Seriously?
I've heard...
No, I'm not doing that. Nope. Not doing that. Sorry.
Okay.
There's an article you can go to of mine on Dandavats called Kinds and Degrees of Illicit Sex. And you can read that, and that's... I'll see if I can put the link in the chat. And I see that... I'll just say that I see that it's a spectrum. Just like everything else. It's a spectrum. So just like if we're going to say, what is 16 rounds? What does it mean to chant 16 rounds? Does it mean you move your fingers on the beads and you say a mantra? Okay, you could say, all right, well, I chanted my 16 rounds. Or does it mean that every word, every syllable is an expression of prema, and the Lord and his internal potency are dancing on your tongue? And then there's a whole realm in between all of that, right? There's offensive chanting, there's clearing stage, there's pure chanting. So when we say, I'm chanting 16 rounds, what does that mean? And if we said to somebody, well, chanting 16 rounds has to mean in prema bhakti, then that would be a problem. You know, if we say that if you're not chanting in Prem Nam, then you're not following your vows. Or another example would be in eating. So generally at initiation, Prabhupada said, no eating meat, fish, or eggs. Generally that was it. Sometimes Prabhupada would add no onions or garlic. And sometimes Prabhupada would add, you should also offer your food. Now we know that we're supposed to offer our food, but what does that mean? So if somebody, let's say that somebody is just vegetarian, are they following their vows? You have to say, yes, they are. Okay, suppose they're vegetarian and they don't have onions and garlic. Well, that's better. Then suppose you're vegetarian without onions and garlic and you offer your food. Okay, then how do you offer your food? Do you just buy chips from the store and you just say, Krishna, please eat this? You know, and then we can go all the way to the top. You're growing your own food, you're cooking your own, or your food is grown by pure brahmanas, it's cooked by pure brahmanas, it's offered to installed deities, you know, on special plates with tulsi leaves at regulated times with love and devotion. And then when you're eating it, with love and devotion, you're eating it in a meditative mood, you're eating it, here's my article, you're eating it in a mood of service. And, you know, I think no gambling is one of the most difficult ones, you know, to define. What does it mean? What do we mean by gambling? Prabhupada would sometimes say mental speculation is gambling. So, again, all of these things have degree, even intoxication, you know. what does it mean? So can you be intoxicated to video games? I don't know. Are we only talking about chemical intoxicants? So I see with illicit sex, there's also a continuum. What does that mean? And one of the most harmful things that we've done, that I see that's been very, very harmful, is we've taken, for some reason, just for this one, the highest thing is the only thing. And we don't do that for anything else. And a point that I've made to people is, of the five vows that Prabhupada had us take in initiation, by the way, we're practically the only Gaudiya group that takes vows at initiation, just as an aside. Generally, the only other Gaudiya groups that have vows at initiation are ones that I'm aware of, and I've done quite a bit of research on it, are ones that had some former connection with ISKCON. But it's not the standard in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, including in the Sarasvat line, to take vows at initiation. But all right, so of the five vows that we take in initiation, I would say unquestionably the most important one is chanting Hare Krishna. Yes?
Absolutely.
All right. So, I mean, even if you're going out eating eggs or something, we want you to chant Hare Krishna. And we accept as devotees in good standing a large range of what does this mean to chant 16 rounds. We really do. I mean, if I just go, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, I'm chanting my rounds, you know, I got my rounds done. I'm a devotee in good standing. Hare Krishna. That's a pretty low level. Yeah? But, okay, that's a devotee, they're chanting their rounds, they're in good standing. And we certainly don't say to people, you know, I mean, Prabhupada talked about the 10 offenses in most initiation lectures, but he never said that, you know, if you're committing any of these offenses, then you're breaking your vows. I mean, that's, forget it. You know, at least I'm finished. And I'd say most of us are finished. So it's, and to chant in pure love, where the Lord and His internal potency are dancing on my tongue, and I've realized, you know, like what Radharani says about the name Krishna, the two syllables Krishna dances in the core of your heart, and all your senses become inert. And how many of us chant like that? Yeah, you know, in discussing this, though, I've run into people who just can't. They just can't wrap their heads around it. No, there's only one standard for illicit sex. I say, that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. That you're going to say that everybody has to be on the top standard all of the time for this, but they don't have to be at the top standard all the time for chanting Hare Krishna. It's like, what? And all that leads to is cheating. That's all. It just simply produces cheating. So there's a range. With all these things, there's a range. There's a minimum, there's a maximum. And get yourself above the minimum and try to go up.
I think that was a pretty thorough answer to my question. Thank you very much.
Yeah, for refusing to answer. Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to answer details. I'm going to answer in principles. Get yourself above the minimum. Don't fall below the minimum. And go up. And be honest, for God's sake. What does Prabhupada say? An honest street sweeper is better than a charlatan meditator. Be honest. You know, honesty is not going to kill you. At least be honest with Krishna. And this... Sorry, Krishna.
I'm sorry, early on there was that sense that if I just chant sincerely enough, then the desire will go away. So it's probably broke up many marriages.
Yeah, well, there's some truth to that. I mean, I have also a video class on sex desire. That, yes, once we're fulfilled in Krishna, then as Prabhupada writes in today's purport, the desire for material sex life becomes vanquished. That's one of the primary symptoms of Shantaras, is just one has no attraction. One actually has this kind of ghastly ecstasy about material sexual pleasure. Because generally, for most people, most of the time, material sexual pleasure is mixed with exploitiveness, generally. Not always, but usually. And, you know, it's on the platform of the body and the mind, and it's mixed with exploitiveness. And so the one who's tasted the ecstasy of Krishna, even on just in Shantaras, which is not even very developed, just sees this other thing as like, why? Why would I want to do that? It just becomes like, what is the point of that? When I'm getting everything that I need, that I want, that I'm fully satisfied with my relationship with Krishna, why would I want to try to have something that's inferior? But imitating that and being artificial, it causes cheating, it causes a degradation of the renounced order, it causes degradation in marriage, and it just makes a mess of things. You know, it's really like that.
Can one look at chanting as a magic formula to deal with all these?
As a magic formula?
Yeah.
If you follow the Trinada P verse, yes. If you don't, no. So, if you really follow the Trinada P, if you really can show all respect to everyone without expecting any respect in return, if you can never be offended, if you are never offended by anyone, ever, if you never feel offended, or whatever feelings of offense you just allow to pass through you, you don't hold on to them, you don't identify with them, and you give all respect to others, then yes. Then one can actually chant, and then chanting is a magic formula, yes. But of course we have a whole life. We don't just have chanting. We have deity worship, we have prasadam, we have spreading the mission of Lord Chaitanya. We're not asked, Srila Prabhupada's not asking us to just simply sit and chant all day long. He's asking us to be active as in the world in some capacity. But yes, chanting is magic if we're following Trinada P. If we're always offended, if we're always angry at people, if we're always criticizing people, we're victims, we're constantly, you know, we're the victims of everything, then chanting is not very effective. Prabhupada said offensive chanting gives you simply good and bad results on the material sphere. On the clearing stage, it gives you liberation, and on the pure stage, it gives you love of God. So if we're chanting, but we're holding on to entitlement, to pride and entitlement, it's still, once you keep chanting, but Lord Kapila Dev says it's like making offerings into ashes. Sorry. All right. I have a class to teach at the Gurukula. So thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.